Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour: clashes between police and demonstrators in Paris during a protest against the killing of three Kurds in the French capital. President Putin calls on Russian defense industry to increase its weapons production to meet the needs of the army for the war in Ukraine. Heavy snow in Japan kills at least 13 people and leaves more than 10,000 households without power. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. In France, clashes have erupted between police and protesters one day after three people of a Kurdish community are killed in the capital, Paris. Police used tear gas to disperse the protesters who hurled rocks to vent their anger. Protesters demand answers over the killings and support and protection from the government. The gun attack happened on Friday at a Kurdish cultural center and a nearby cafe. Investigations are underway. Police have arrested a 69-year-old man. He is known to have a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. The Russian president urges the country's defense industry to increase its production to meet the needs of forces fighting in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has told the industry's chiefs to make sure that the army receives the military equipment in the shortest possible time. He made the remarks during a visit to a weapon manufacturing center. Putin also said the industry should improve the technical quality of the equipment. This comes as Western countries, especially the U.S., have been supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced weapons since the beginning of the war in February. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved the $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. The military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that has passed the Senate. It will now go to U.S. President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in the war with Russia. It has already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Russia has repeatedly warned that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate the human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest point in decades. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of the relations to an ice age, warning of the high risk of a clash.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO.
Is the UK having Brexit buyer's remorse, or is the departure from the European Union delivering? The country in its longest recession on record Britons are starting to examine the real consequences of leaving the EU. Syed Purisa reports.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Syed Purisa, London.
China says it is resolutely opposed to a new U.S. law that boosts military assistance for Taiwan. Beijing says the law contains provisions that causes serious damage to peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Taipei, however, has welcomed the legislation, which will provide it with $10 billion in security aid. Taiwan says the U.S. move shows the importance that Washington attaches to ties with the island and its security. Taiwan has been a source of tension between China and the U.S. for years. That is because the U.S. continues to supply arms to the island, which China considers its own territory. Beijing says Washington's assistance emboldens Taipei in its independence push. In a call between the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, he accused the U.S. of attempting to suppress China's development. He warned Washington against trying to challenge China's red lines using salami-slicing tactics.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. As Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan, Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency when anti-China rhetoric began were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated.
The U.S. sees its hegemony challenged by a quickly emerging superpower that, based on most estimates, is bound to overtake it as the number one economy in the world. Washington has resorted to unorthodox tactics to halt its main rival's growth and progress. Those methods are not received well by China. The U.S. is provoking China militarily while simultaneously trying to draw regional countries into its own sphere and away from China. One hot-button issue is Taiwan.
In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing one-China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the six assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and, more recently, had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
COVID keeps surging rapidly across China, with daily infections topping 500,000 in a single city alone. Local media in Qingdao say that the eastern city has been seeing between 490 and 530,000 new cases a day. They have cited a city health official, but did not specify the period during which the surge took place. The same official has predicted an approaching peak and said infections will rise by 10% at the weekend. Other Chinese cities have also faced a surge in infections ever since the government ended its zero COVID policy this month. Snap lockdowns, lengthy quarantines, and travel curbs have all been lifted. The World Health Organization has expressed concern over the virus surge in China. Heavy snow has left at least 13 people dead in Japan over the last week. Dozens more have been injured. That, according to Japanese public broadcaster NHK. Snowstorms have hit areas across northern, eastern, and western Japan since December 17. Thousands of households have suffered power blackouts. Heavy snow has also caused massive traffic jams, disrupting train and airplane services. Thousands of flights have been canceled in the U.S. as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were canceled on Friday and Thursday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The Federal Aviation Administration imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways as a result of the storms. Some 4,000 U.S. flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel in the holiday season, forcing the cancellation of dozens of trains. Festivities are underway in Bethlehem, the biblical birthplace of Jesus, and the Palestinian city in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. People have converged on Manger Square, carrying flags and beating drums on Christmas Eve. The square has been decorated with fireworks, light shows, and an illuminating giant tree. The main attraction in Bethlehem is the 4th century Church of the Nativity. That's where Jesus was born, according to Christian tradition. The Christmas season offers measured cheer for Palestinians in the city, which is separated from Al-Quds by an Israeli apartheid barrier. Bethlehem was closed for the last two Christmas seasons because of the COVID pandemic. That reduced the number of tourists. However, this year, the Palestinian Tourism Minister expects that the number will increase. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world. Meanwhile, a new study reveals that this country ranks last among peer nations for COVID-19 mortality. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The United States ranks dismally among its peer nations when it comes to deaths from COVID-19. Dismal might not be a strong enough adjective, actually. The U.S. ranked dead last among its peer nations with the most deaths per capita. The data comes from a new study published in a medical journal, JAMA, which also analyzed the state-by-state vaccination and public health data. Alarmingly, researchers noted that if every state in the United States had the same vaccination rates as those states with the highest vaccination rates, more than 100,000 lives would have been saved. Led by researchers from the Brown University School of Public Health and the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, the JAMA study compared data on vaccinations and COVID-19 mortality in 2021 and 2022 between the United States and 20 other most populous countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Not surprisingly, the per capita death rate was higher in America than any of those other 20 countries during the Delta and Omicron waves in 2021 and 2022, with America accumulating 370,298 COVID-19 fatalities in total. Yet the data was particularly illuminating when the authors compared the 10 U.S. states with the highest vaccination rates with those that had the lowest vaccination rates. According to JAMA's study, the per capita rate of COVID-19 death in the 10 states with the highest vaccination rates, 73%, was 75 deaths out of every 100,000 people. By contrast, the 10 states with the lowest rates of vaccination, 52%, had a per capita death rates of 146 out of 100,000 people. But on an international scale, the numbers looked bad too. The 10 most vaccinated states had an excess all-cause mortality rate that was equal to or less than that of several other OECD countries, including Denmark, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Austria, and Finland. The phrase all-cause mortality rate refers to the total death rate based on all causes of death within a total population for a given period of time. That number is meaningful because many deaths that were on paper from other causes were indirectly caused by COVID-19. The authors of the study conclude from June 27, 2021 to March 26, 2022, the U.S. would have averted 122,304 deaths if COVID-19 mortality matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states and 266,700 deaths if U.S. excess all-cause mortality rate matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states. If the U.S. matched the rates of other peer countries, averted deaths would have been substantially higher in most cases, including range 154,622, 357,899 for COVID-19 mortality, 209,924, 465,747 for all-cause mortality. This means that if the 10 states which had the fewest number of vaccinated citizens had been inoculated at the rates of 10 states with the highest percentage of vaccinated citizens, roughly 122,000 people who died of COVID-19 during the 9-month period covered by the study would have lived instead. Similarly, if throughout the United States the total amount of excess deaths from all causes had been the same as in the 10 most highly vaccinated states, more than 266,000 deaths would have been avoided. The United States' dismal public health ratings owe a debt to the haze of vaccine misinformation that pervades the United States and which has become dogma among some right-wing politicians who have encouraged the spread of public health misinformation for political gain. Although anti-vaccine conspiracy theories became increasingly popular due to the COVID-19 pandemic, they long preceded it. In 1998, soon-to-be discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield published a case series which claimed that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, MMR vaccine, was linked to the development of autistic traits in young people. A panic ensued until it became clear that Wakefield's paper was riddled with problems. It had no data about MMR vaccine, included speculative conclusions, only reviewed a small sample of patients, and used a poorly designed experimental model. It later came out that Wakefield also had financial conflicts of interest, which he had not disclosed when publishing the study. Anti-vaccine ideas became more prevalent in 2020s after the COVID-19 pandemic reached the United States. Popular podcaster Joe Rogan touted supposed COVID-19 treatments that didn't work, such as horse dewormer in vermistin. Rogan's ideas spread thanks to other anti-vaccine celebrities. There is no scientific evidence indicating that purported COVID-19 treatments like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vitamin C, and vitamin D are effective in stopping COVID-19 infections, while monoclonal antibodies can be effective, and Paxlovid works well. Both are second-line defenses that are much more likely to be given to the unvaccinated when they contract the virus, as unvaccinated persons typically have far worse outcomes if and when they contract COVID-19. According to Guardian, the U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world, despite spending the highest percentage of its GDP on healthcare. According to a new report from the Commonwealth Fund, the country struggles with deep problems in affordability of healthcare, which affects access and equity, and it is the country that has the most administrative hurdles when dealing with the healthcare issue. This is despite the U.S. spending 17% of its gross domestic product on healthcare, far above the other 10 countries, according to the report. The other countries analyzed in the report were Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the U.K. The ranking is based on 71 measures across five areas: access to care, care process, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. The report notes that unlike the other countries in the study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. A larger percentage of Americans say they spend a lot of time on paperwork for medical bills, and doctors report having more trouble prescribing medication for patients because of restrictive health insurance coverage. The report notes that unlike the other countries in this study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. Americans also deal with lackluster access to care, with more American adults going to the emergency room for non-emergency care. Doctors of top-performing countries are usually readily available by phone or on night and weekend. The U.S. also has the largest disparity in care among income groups. We have almost two healthcare systems in America. one for people with means and insurance, and another one that falls short for people who are uninsured or don't have adequate insurance coverage. Eric Schindler, the lead author of the report and senior vice president for policy and research at the Commonwealth Fund, told Washington Post. Health statistics reflect the reality of having the worst healthcare system on the list. The U.S. has the highest infant, maternal, and avoidable mortality rates. The country also has less support for early childhood education and support systems, like unemployment protection for workers, leading to poorer health outcomes.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episodes, we have been talking about the changes that take place at the adolescent stage. What could parents do to manage these changes? Because we told that education about the changes is important, and equally management of those changes is important. Now we know that it's important, but we don't know the good ways. So could you just suggest their parents with some alternatives to stop those arousings, or actually to come out, or to actually manage them?
The important thing is the management of the thoughts and then the feelings. The thoughts, one should not allow his imagination or her imagination run wild. Think of things which are attractive, which are seducive. They need to be managed. They need to be controlled. One has to engage in other activities which takes his mind away or her mind away from these things. And activities should be engaged in which are cause him to get to concentrate on into issues which are of a deep understanding, which require deep understanding. As I mentioned, mathematics or philosophy or other subjects which are important in one's life. Secondly, practical activities such as sports.
Okay.
Parents should try to engage their children in sport activities, give them, provide them opportunities for swimming, for any other thing which is any sort of sport which would take his mind off those things. Another thing which is important, that the person should impose upon himself certain self-restraint. For example, by fasting, one of the things which has been emphasized in the traditions also is that one goes for fasting. And that is a very important source of controlling one's feelings.
That's the philosophy of it.
Yes. So I think fasting is one way. Another thing which has to be taken care of is, for example, the appearances, the clothing, It should neither be in such a way that it attracts the opposite sex, nor should it be in such a way that one tries because starts to admire oneself by way of the apparent features, his or her clothing.
But that's what adolescents do the most. They like when they are in this age, they put on the more like boys put on the huge number of gels on their hair. The girls try to, since they see the changes in their bodies, and now they try to show more and more.
Show off themselves.
Exactly.
That is the major
mismanagement.
Yes, that is the inclination mostly, but that has to be controlled. I mean, it's not just for girls to take care of their appearances, and they should not be using lipstick or rouge or whatever which makes them gives them an. I mean, a lady
extra
can,
beautiful look.
Yes, maybe a lady is wearing all the proper clothing, the hijab, as it, the covering is there, but the way she talks, the way she walks, that could become attractive, or puts on lipstick or other things. So these should be refrained from completely. And boys should also take care of their clothing and their covering in such a way that it is not seductive for girls. It's both ways. Even their hairstyle. I mean, even therefore, it is very much emphasized. Maybe you go for a haircut, completely make yourself bald.
All right.
I mean, that is something which has to be done. Otherwise, the other thing is that if you don't do this, the problem is that you would get entrapped into a situation where you need to release those.
But getting out would be very difficult for you.
Getting out would be difficult,
yeah.
To release that energy, to remove those feelings. One would have to go for something which is not allowed.
Yeah. Well, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing how one could manage the changes that are taking place in the adolescence. Professor Naqavi, you said one of the best ways is to engage in sports. It is to engage in the subjects like philosophy, mathematics, science. And it's not just about the appearance of girls when it comes to hijab. It's also about boys who have to be very, very modest in their appearance.
Some of the maraji have this ruling that their opinion is that boys, men generally, they shouldn't even remove their upper coverings, their shirts also for in front of non-mahram women.
Okay.
That's why, because even in the Muharram processions where we have this, men are coming out for beating their chests and for this expression of sorrow for Imam Hussein, even there, they're not allowed to remove their upper clothing, so that it does not cause a difficult situation.
So this is very, very important over here, that even for the pious cause, you cannot use the un-Islamic ways.
Exactly. The ends can never be a justification for the means. You cannot justify doing things which are wrong for the sake of a good purpose. That's a general law. Everyone accepts that. And if one has come to a situation where one cannot control those feelings, then he will or she will be forced to do things which are not allowed, adultery or, God forbid, any other things which are prohibited in Islam, then one should go for marriage. And one shouldn't, it's not that one should go, the parents should be doing that. Because the Quran addresses the society at large. وَأَنْكِحُ الْأَيَّامَ مِنْكُمْ. It's not the children who are being addressed. The society, the parents, marry your young ones who need to, who are in the need of marriage. So it's the responsibility upon society. Now, the problem with society today is, my boy does not start to earn a good living. He does not get a good source of income. How can I marry him off? How the girls would say, look, if I don't have a husband who can support me properly, how am I going to, why should I marry someone? I need a person who is stable. No, that is not what Islam is saying. Islam is saying whenever you have the need, either you have managed yourself, you have controlled yourself, you have been able to bring your children up in such a way that they're able to manage themselves, their feelings, their thoughts into an age which where those feelings subside, and then that is okay at a later age. And they get married in the 20s, in the mid-20s maybe. But if that is not the case, then even as a teenager, 18 years, 19 years, one should be prepared and should have had the grooming to be able to manage a family. As I said, that's the age of completion of the intellect. The rushd should be achieved in such a way that he is able to manage a family. The society, the parents should support him and gradually build up the family.
Yes, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we're discussing how to manage the changes of adolescence. Yes, Professor Nakavi.
Yes, as I was saying, so generally the society which Islam is looking forward to is a society which is not in stress. It feels relaxed, satisfied with itself and with has a good relationship with one's Lord Allah Almighty, and رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُمْ وَرَضُوا عَنْهُ. That is the situation which we need to achieve in our lives. Pure life, hayat, tayyiba, that is necessary, and it is through the management of our feelings and thoughts and our actions. Especially adolescence is a very important age for that. A pivotal stage, a transformation of the human life cycle, a very important life cycle, prepared to become an adult. So when one is at the later stage of teenagehood, 18, 19, 20, he should be a complete adult, where boys and girls, men and women, can become even married and manage a life. And if wants to, of course, it is better to, for example, complete one's education, higher level studies, professional education, and then go for marriage. There's no doubt about that. Of course, if one is alone, he has to take care of himself or herself only, mid-20s, that's okay. But if it is not possible, and these 5 years of higher studies are going to be stressful, there's a continuous source of stress. And issues may cause maybe depression.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this situation is not appropriate. This is not called for. And there is no wrong in getting married at even before higher studies and going for professional studies. And there, the society should come in. I mean, if a family has a boy and a girl, a boy is married at an early age, a girl is married off, the girl goes, the daughter-in-law comes in. So what's the difference? The balance is maintained.
Yeah.
So that shouldn't be a problem. If a family, parents are going to manage a boy and a girl, or two boys and two girls, when they marry off their girl at an early age, their daughter-in-law comes in. So that shouldn't be a cause of a problem for the family. Of course, that can also, that can only happen in a society which is balanced, which is which has the proper sources of income. The society has, poverty has been alleviated from society. This is something which we all should struggle for, according to Islam's teachings, to achieve a stage where the society becomes a welfare society, a society where poverty is not there. If there's a difference in the rich and the poor, the difference is not great. No one is poor. The class difference is not that much. Now the problem is, one of the issues which we face in society, one of the social issues, is that we have girls who are not their marriage is being delayed because of the fact they don't have enough dowry. They don't have the, their parents do not have the resources to marry them off. Boys also have faced a similar situation. So that, of course, goes back to problems in our economy.
Yeah.
We're not managing the economy properly. Whether it is the economy of the state, whether it is the economy of the of a society, of a family even.
Yeah.
So we need to do work on the, all these things.
Yes. So the actual thing is basically the management of thoughts by the teenager himself, which could help him eventually in the further fields of life. As Allama Iqbal puts it, sitaron se aage jahan aur bhi hai, abhi ishq ke imtihan aur bhi hai, which means there are worlds beyond the stars. There are still tests of your love. There are still tests of love yet to come. With that, we end our today's session. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In September, the U.S. created a foundation that was supposed to unfreeze Afghanistan's foreign assets. Yet, interviews with trustees revealed that in 3 months, no funds have been disbursed. No concrete plans have been made to help the Afghan people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan in August 2021, and in response, Europe, the UAE, and the U.S. froze the Afghan central bank's roughly $9 billion in foreign assets, $7 billion of which was under control of the U.S. regime. Without access to these funds, alongside a lattice of sanctions, a decline in humanitarian aid, and harsh political turmoil under Taliban, Afghanistan has been led into an economic collapse with a dramatic uptick in poverty. 6 million Afghans are facing the immediate risk of starvation. According to calculations from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR, a left-leaning think tank, U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan, including the freezing of these central bank assets, could kill more people than 20 years of U.S. war and occupation. In September, the Biden administration placed half of the U.S.-controlled assets into a private foundation, trusted by just four people, to be used for the benefit of the people of Afghanistan while keeping them out of the hands of malign actors, according to a joint statement from the Departments of Treasury and State. But interviews with two of those four trustees revealed that no funds have yet been dispersed to help Afghan people, and there are no policies in place to do so immediately. One trustee underscored that it is unlikely the foundation will be a vehicle to quickly return the assets to Afghanistan's central bank while the Taliban is maintaining oppressive rule. This lack of progress raises concerns that the Biden administration is on course to worsen the rapidly spiraling humanitarian crisis. Who pays the price, asks Basir Bita, an Afghan activist who works with the Afghan refugee community in Canada and who has family in Afghanistan. For the U.S. freezing the funds, the public, the people who live in Afghanistan. The U.S. regime froze the Afghan central bank's assets amid public outcry over the U.S. military's withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Biden administration depicted the move as a refusal to legitimize Taliban rule. Yet, according to Andres Arroz, a senior research fellow at the CEPR, the reality is that central banks don't just hold government money. They also and mostly hold commercial banks' money. They're not only banks of governments, they're also banks of banks. It was important for the working of Afghanistan's financial system and therefore its economy that their banks have access to money that was seized by the U.S. The freezing of the assets plunged Afghanistan into a liquidity crisis in which people are unable to access their cash and perform essential transactions. Alongside the liquidity crisis is hyperinflation, which has worsened the acute and widespread problem of hunger. Between June 2021 and July 2022, the price of wheat flour in Afghanistan skyrocketed 68% and cooking oil jumped 55%, according to the National Committee of the Red Cross. 70% of homes are unable to meet basic food and non-food needs. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies warned in June. Reports have emerged of Afghans selling their daughters, their kidneys, in effort to survive hunger and rising debt. Citing the deepening catastrophe, some activists and lawmakers have been calling for the Biden administration to take a less collectively punitive approach and return the assets to Afghanistan's central bank. In January, the New York Times editorial board published an op-ed warning against the policy of letting the Afghan central bank fall apart, titled, "Let Innocent Afghans Have Their Money." In the midst of all of this, in February, The Biden administration issued an executive order to set aside $3.5 billion of the U.S. held central bank assets for victims of the attacks of September 11, 2001, though lawmakers and lobbyists stand to profit handsomely. This move was widely criticized by UN experts and some 9/11 families for its disastrous humanitarian consequences for Afghans. On September 14th, the U.S. Departments of Treasury and State announced the other half of the U.S.-controlled reserves of the Afghan Central Bank. Another $3.5 billion would be placed under the control of a Swiss foundation called the Afghan Fund. The Afghan Fund would maintain its account with the Bank for International Settlements, which is a global financial institution based in Switzerland that provides banking services for central banks. Afghan men carrying a sack of flour in January, as the UN World Food Program distributes monthly food rations in an area south of Kabul. Between June 2021 and July 2022, the price of wheat flour in Afghanistan skyrocketed 68%. According to a statement from the Bank of International Settlements, its role is limited to providing banking services and it plays no part in decision-making of the Afghan Fund. In the short term, the Afghan Fund's Board of Trustees will have the ability to authorize targeted disbursements to promote monetary and macroeconomic stability and benefit the Afghan people. According to the joint statement from Treasury and State, the foundation could, for example, use the assets to pay for critical imports like electricity or to pay for Afghanistan's arrears at international financial institutions to preserve their eligibility for financial support. The Afghan Fund's long-term goal is to return the funds to the Afghan Central Bank, but only if key assets and counterterrorism controls are implemented, the statement indicates. Some activists and members of the U.S. Congress cautiously supported the creation of the Afghan Fund, hoping it marked a step forward to the United States on freezing the assets. The fund has the potential to create a vital pathway to a functioning financial system, returning desperately needed assets to Afghanistan that could alleviate major price spikes of food and other essentials. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, wrote in a September 15th statement. The press coverage surrounding the Afghan Fund intimated a major unlocking of the assets could be just around the corner. Setting up the new fund will enable the funds to flow quickly, Kylie Atwood wrote for CNN. But now, 3 months later, no money has been distributed, and two of the Afghan Fund's trustees say there is no immediate plan to return assets to the Afghan Central Bank.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.